So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to Review Man.
A sick son of a bitch. Damn gas leak. Look at these people here in this arena. I don't even know what we witnessed, Cole. I mean, you can't even breathe. The gasoline.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's black smoke has filled the Toyota Center here. You can smell the fumes. And we just witnessed, ladies and gentlemen, Randy Orton. He poured gasoline into an open hole of this casket. The Undertaker was inside, and then he set the casket on fire.
I don't understand it. Why? For what? You won the damn match. You're the legend killer. We get it. There's a human being in there. There's a man in there. For what? For what?
I can't answer that question. Only Randy Orton and perhaps his father knows. There was a human being in that casket, and Randy Orton set it on fire.
Somebody call 911. Shawty fire burning on the dance floor. Whoa. What's up, Quad? Kingston, let's go, hey! Red one, hey, hey! Shawty got that super thing, hotter than the sun in the south of Spain. Got me soon as I walk through the door. Oh, my pockets started tickling, the way she dropped below that thing. Got me wanna spend my money on her.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock with you, and as Way continues on his California vacation, joining us this week to chat about No Mercy 2005, always a good pal to this show. He is former lead writer for SmackDown, Alex Greenfield, who is coming back to chat about WWE No Mercy 2005 to put the definitive stamp on that particular pay-per-view. Mr. Greenfield, thank you so much for stepping in this week.
Absolutely. The definitive stamp. That makes me sound about 6 degrees more important than I probably should. But no, we've been talking about doing this for a while now. Of course, Way would bail on me because that's what he'd do. But no, I'm psyched to talk about it. This was a really interesting time, and I thought we sort of had some of the best and worst of my time in SmackDown on it.
Now, for those of you out there, Alex joined the team in April of 2005. So by this time, was this before you were the lead writer of SmackDown? You were just writing on the team?
Yeah, I was just a writer on the team. It's actually June 2005 I started, and I was a writer-producer on the time. I was producing things backstage, too. Dave Lagana was the head writer, and Court Bauer was on the team. Ted DiBiase was on the team. It was a neat mix.
At this time as well, this was very much the focus at that time was the fact that the WWE was going back to the USA Network. And the Monday going into this show was that massive Raw homecoming show where every single person in the world was contacted to come on, including Kevin Von Erich, who I remember being just the star of that show in Dallas. But I remember so clearly at that point was the fact that they spent all of this time on that 3-hour Raw that night. And No Mercy was really an afterthought. Everything was focused on homecoming that night.
And it was such an interesting shift, and it happened right after SummerSlam. Like they were – and it's not that Vince at that point stopped being high on Dave, but it was a real priority through transferring him over to SmackDown, which happened just before I got there. I think the week before I got there. And sort of building him from that feud with Triple H to sort of putting a final nail in the coffin of JBL as sort of the representative SmackDown champion and building Dave up. And then as soon as SummerSlam ended, everything in the world became homecoming and they just kind of forgot about us. And that's sort of where we got the freedom to do, you know, bringing Palmer Cannon and the new talent initiative in and starting all of these new guys. And, you know, it was Palmer who sort of stole the mic from Teddy, who set this match up because we were like, do we do a number one contenders program? Do we do this? All we knew is we wanted to get to Eddie and Dave. Because it would be such a contrast just in terms of the working of the whole stylization of the program, such a contrast between JBL and Dave Bautista and Eddie. And just having Palmer Cannon as this plot device for, you know, he was the network executive on the kayfabe network executive, saying that he wanted this to expand Latino demographics was just the easiest plot device in the world. And dude, when Vince was paying attention, he never would have let us get away with half of the stuff we were doing at that point.
And it's so funny looking back, especially at that summer of 2005 that was going on. It, at SmackDown at that point, you had the shift where Cena went to Raw, Batista came into as SmackDown, so you essentially flip-flopped your two top baby faces on each show. You also had that Eddie Guerrero, Rey Mysterio program all summer long, yep. And then tailing into this in the fall, but also The Undertaker's big program that summer, and that kind of compares to today, it's kind of the controversy this week with Rusev, was with Muhammad Hassan, which just they had to drop in July, and that ultimately ended going back to Taker, Randy Orton. Was that essentially, was it always to get to Orton, as you recall, or was Hassan going to be a long, drawn-out program with
Taker? No, he was definitely going to be a much longer and more drawn-out program. The way that I got over and sort of started rising through the ranks instead of, I mean, because writers are really kind of viewed as disposable when they first come in. Because so many people come in and go out, you know, they do or at least in my day, they did a 3-week trial period and then a 3-month trial period. And I think, you know, I was there for a year and 9 months, I think. And I think probably a good 20 writers came through, either quitting or just never showing up again after their 3-week trial or whatever. And one of the things that was sort of a bummer about the human resources team, I am not, as you are well aware, a particularly quiet and taciturn fellow. And one of the things that the human resources lady says when you're first starting out on the writer's team is, now remember, these first 3 weeks are all about staying quiet and just listening and learning the world and all of that. And there is, believe me, there's a ton of that, but I was no good at staying quiet. And we were in an agent's meeting before I think it was a Raw, actually. So it was weird that it came up. And I remember we were in Baltimore, which is just the shittiest arena backstage to work in. Like, it's designed in a very old school way. The power is always blowing out. Like, it just sucked to produce in at that point. Anyway, we're sitting in an agent's meeting and Vince basically opens the floor. He says, what are we going to do about Hassan? Because UPN at that point had said no fucking way that showing back up on our network. And we were trying to think, they were going through all of these different Byzantine ideas for how to get hype for the match with Undertaker and for Undertaker. How can we move this program, basically? I wish I could remember what the pitch was, because it's what ended up actually happening. But I finally, everybody's just stymied, and there's this long, pregnant pause, and I pitched whatever ended up happening. And I think that's when Vince learned my name, as opposed to me just being generic writer who's going to watch out in a couple of weeks, you know, you know, see. But it was a total bummer, and it was a real bummer for, I forget his shoot name, but the guy who played Hassan. Because he had this long-term program planned, and they just went a bridge too far, sort of like they did at Battleground, and the guy really suffered for it. Hopefully that's not the case with Rusev, and I don't think it will be, because it's also not, you know, terrorists coming out and garroting the Undertaker on television, you know, a couple of years after 9/11 at the height of the Iraq War.
Yeah, very, very different circumstances. But I thought you had one of the best tweets on the weekend regarding Jack Swagger and Zeb Coulter's recent turn and acceptance by the fans, saying, I'm amazed at – I'm paraphrasing, but amazed at how the fans have taken to him, and also a little depressed at how easy the transition has been.
I know, dude. I really do. And I know I got blown up with a lot of tweets from my my more conservative friends who their basic argument is, look, this was always a split issue. And there was always a base in the audience who legitimately does support – at least in the broad strokes, Swagger's point of view. I don't think they're as extreme, you know, deport everybody who doesn't look like you or whatever. I find that a fallacious argument. That, like, this dude was a jingoistic nationalist heel and simply by virtue of, you know, doing battle with the Bulgarian brute, we forget that, you know, every person who isn't from this country, from the United States, was a presumed illegal alien who should be swept. It just, the ease with which he transitioned bums me out a little.
Were you surprised at all with the statement that when the WWE on Monday received all of the negative press regarding it, and their response was that, well, these have been longstanding characters on our programming, and the promo on Sunday had nothing to do with the Malaysian aircraft. That is, people just essentially, they're insinuating, oh, you guys are just drawing conclusions here.
Yeah,
to me, it's like, if you're going to go into that territory, then stand by it and say, hey, we're telling this story. These are our villain characters. Or you apologize, but yeah,
I think the non-disingenuous mood would have been to say, these are longstanding characters, and this is the kind of thing they should say in character. But Raw is a different kind of entertainment thing. This isn't an episode of Homeland. We apologize. That's not what they did. They gave this, you know, Jerry McDivitt, a very mealy mouth response. And look, we all know, exactly what it was referencing. And the thing that I tweeted last night, I hate referring to tweets, it's so douchey, but, the first thing that occurred to me is, you know, as soon as I knew Rusev was coming out, was, I wonder how far they went in the writer's room before they pulled it back to whatever they're going to say, because you just knew they were going to address it. And I know that somewhere along the way it was pitched to just go all the way with it, because that's what you do in the writer's room, and it's terrible sometimes.
Well, as we look ahead here to No Mercy 2005 taking place in Houston, Texas, where does Houston rank in comparison on the scale of 0 to 10, 0 being Baltimore, 10 being, I don't know.
Staples or what's the Minnesota, the Target?
Target Center.
Target Center is really, really well laid out too. It is, it's a funny thing. I'm going to put it right in the middle because I don't have any very specific recollections of the Houston Arena. That means it's probably just somewhere in the middle, because most of them run together for me.
I would say the most eye-opening thing I've ever heard out of yourself and Court is the real Madison Square Garden.
Oh, like, what God, it sucks.
What a shithole this place is, that you would just assume is the most pristine arena in the entire country.
And it presents that way. And inside, it's just awful. It's awful to work in. It is still a 2 or a 3, though, over Baltimore.
Wow, Baltimore. I'm going to avoid Baltimore at all costs.
You know, fans from Baltimore can let me know. Maybe things have changed, but boy, it was the worst place to work in. Not the fans, but from a production perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. The show starts off with a video about Eddie Guerrero showing his past addictions and says he has a new addiction. That is winning. And they're basically playing the fact that he's going to turn. Batista knows he's going to turn, but everyone is supposed to buy into this new Eddie Guerrero. And it was very eerie to go back, Alex, because this was Eddie's last pay-per-view. This was a month before he passed away. And just the imagery in this opening video, you have kind of, you know, the WWE B-roll of pills and alcohol. And then we cut to a graveyard with the casket match for the Ortons against the Undertaker, and just the combination of the two, very eerie to watch.
I mean, and in retrospect, it was, you know, sort of going through the show, and, you know, I knew this was coming up. I watched it sort of segmented over the course of the weekend. God, yeah, it's so creepy, right? Like, a lot of the writers you talk to got, like, all kinds of toys and poster, you know, all kinds of WWE kitschy stuff, right? There was something about that original. I didn't take very much at all. Like, I have a couple of WWE pens. Like, I have grown-up bullshit. But there was something about that poster well before Eddie's death, and, you know, in the summer with him looking back over his shoulder with the No Mercy logo being a tattoo. It was just such a great photograph. That's one of the only posters I ever took one home and still have it hanging on my wall. Everything about it, cast in the light of hindsight, feels like this interesting foreshadowing Obviously, none of us had any idea. You know, we the whole idea first, people should know the idea of the babyface Eddie going into this program was Eddie's idea. It was he and I and Dave Lagana sitting around and bullshitting approaches to take right before we generated the program. I think maybe even on the night of it being announced. We wanted to do something different coming out of Ray. And the easiest thing in the world would have been for just heel Eddie to go after Batista. But Eddie wanted to try this complicated thing. And the thing that I think made Eddie's performance so successful is Eddie talking about himself, Eddie Guerrero, the character, said, what I want to get across is that Eddie doesn't know which way Eddie's going to go. And I think it pays off when we get there talking about the match at No Mercy. I think it pays off in spades. I fucking love this match. I think it's undervalued. But the
and
way
I also
Eddie
I also
played
just...
everything is like he wasn't playing. I'm being like Paige and AJ have recently been performing, right? That they're utterly disingenuous in their babyface feelings towards each other. Eddie always tried to play it like that there was conflict within Eddie. That he really did want to try and be a better man, like through this crucible of 6 months he'd been through with Rage, with Ray, that he's trying to turn over a new leaf, but just can't quite do it. And then he holds on through the match. It was he was such an incredible performer, dude. Like, did you ever get to interview him or talk to him?
I did. I did get to interview him actually earlier that year in 2005. It would have been going into WrestleMania that year. And he was actually very tight with the former host of Live Audio Wrestling, a guy named Jeff Merrick. So I know he used to come on our show quite a lot before I was even a part of it and stuff like that. But it was amazing because in 2005, he had reached a level as a performer that few could touch at that time, and really over the course of the last generation, I would say. And you could see that his body was failing him, but his performance level was just at such a different level at that point in time. You almost just could have wished if both could have come into sync at some point. I mean, it would have been scary because you just saw stuff clicking in 2005, that the kind of thing that when it does – that's where you get a money-making performer, and that's what Eddie was totally feeling like from mid-2005 onwards.
It's a kind of amazing thing in that I think I've talked with you about this before. The best pair of matches I saw the whole time I worked at WWE was this pair of house show matches from right around the same period. I think it was sort of late August, right after SummerSlam, between Eddie and The Undertaker. And there are so many things going into that match. Eddie was straight heel. This was just a house show loop through Tennessee. I think it was Knoxville and somewhere else. And, I mean, there were a lot of questions about it because Eddie was one of the people talked about with Undertaker's WrestleMania program for WrestleMania 23. And people kind of wanted to get an idea of what the match would look like with, you know, Undertaker's back in his supernatural characterization and Eddie's a straight heel. So these matches were so blow away good, man. Like, you think a guy 5'7", 5'8" facing The Undertaker, who's legitimately the boys, mind you, Joey Mercury was one of them. I couldn't remember everyone who were legitimately worried that they were working around some kind of injury The Undertaker had sustained. Like, they were that good together. It was just master craftsmen at work. Eddie at this point was like, I get the impression there were lots of problems, and this is just stories, I wasn't there, during Eddie's run at the top. And he, by the time I got there, had pulled himself together and was just pulling out a level of performance that, with the exception of one or two specific things, as a week-in, week-out performer, nobody was better during my time at WWE than Eddie Guerrero. He was just tremendous.
Well, let's get into the show here. It opens up. Our announcers, Michael Cole and Taz, for the night, where Michael Cole starts off the night by asking the question, are you ready for more memories to be performed tonight? Are you ready to perform some memories tonight, Alex?
I think, you know, maybe he read an early draft of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And yeah. I mean, creating memories is, you know, Inception level shit. So I think you can only call that ahead of the curve.
That's why we're having you on the show, Alex. The memory performer, Alex Greenfield. Eminem comes out with Melina for our opening six-person tag. And Cole avoids saying the word bitch, which is written on Melina's shirt. So apparently there was reason enough to hesitate saying the word bitch. But this came right at the same time as there is a camera going up Melina's skirt at the time. So interesting dichotomy of what was acceptable or not.
Those cameras, they were practically gynecological for a while there. It's crazy how tight some of those shots were. Like, even, man, Brazilian waxing, I think, is clearly part of the deal.
Clearly a business expense for Melina.
No, right?
So we had Eminem and Melina against the new formed Legion of Doom, Animal and John Heidenreich, who were the tag champions at the time, and Christy Hemme, who was aligned with them at this point in time. They showed an angle from SmackDown 2 days prior where Christy Hemme took the snapshot, but Taz then informs us that Christy Hemme has decided not to wear a neck collar tonight despite taking this spot on Friday, which begged the question what the point of the spot was then.
I think, and I swear this is true, I think, because I think you probably know this, like, I wrote this screed about Kevin Dunn a couple of weeks ago over at Cage Side Seats in their comments section, but yes. This could have been another example, because I think, if my recollection is correct, we were backstage, and Melina was walking around in the collar, and Kevin Dunn said, "She doesn't look as good with the collar," and changed on the day. Just changed, awesome. Just randomly changed our booking because she doesn't look as good in the collar.
Of course.
Yeah.
Heidenreich had his like voodoo style face paint. Animal's left shoulder is all taped up. Everyone was a mess in here. Animal selling more than Christy Hemme.
I know.
Look at that. Eminem just double teams him. They attack the shoulder throughout the match. Eventually, Animal catches Joey Mercury coming off the top of the power slam. Melina tags herself in, climbs to the top, and gets caught by Animal, who just blatantly just gropes her ass. Tags in Christy Hemme. They hit a heart attack, and then Hemme performs a Hurricane Rana that would just send Scott Steiner into an absolute panic attack watching this thing being executed in his name. Animal then hoists up Melina. Hemme hits the Doomsday Device and pins her at 6 minutes, 22 seconds. Crowd did enjoy the finish, and the announcers state that Road Warrior Hawk would be proud. That might have been going a little far.
I didn't know the man, but that seems like a little bit of a reckless assertion to me. Just personally. No, I mean, it's funny. Do you know that the first pre-tape that I solo shot, that I wasn't working with Bruce Pritchard, and I moved up into that, I think second or third week I was there, was basically the introduction of the Road Warriors with it's like even calling them the Legion of Doom is ridiculous, with Heidenreich joining in. And it was this thing like Animal is standing at a mirror and Heidenreich steps up beside him, stepping up to be his partner. I can't remember exactly, but it was the most awkward thing because I couldn't, to get the camera effect I wanted of Heidenreich stepping into the mirror behind him, backing him up. Animal just wouldn't position himself. And I'm trying to do it in the Hollywood directing way, which is you never give an actor a line reading or tell them the blocking. It's just sort of the etiquette of things. You try and bring them to it instead of doing it. And I go to Steph and I'm like, I can't get this guy to do what I want him to do. And she was like, what do you mean, Alex? You can't make him do what you want him to do. And I'm like, I keep trying to, you know, get him to the place where he's standing in the mirror the right way so that we can get the shot with the blah, 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 blah. And she's like, come here. And we walk back into the room and I look at Steph and I'm like, so what do we do? And she's like, how do you want him to be? And I sort of explain. And she says, Animal, do this. And she just sort of grabs his shoulders, positions him, and the shot goes off perfectly and without a hitch. And that's when I realized directing talent in WWE is very different from directing them on a show in Hollywood.
That to me is like one of the greatest microcosms of what the WWE.
Yeah.
You know, they just – their own rules. You know what I mean? But they get – the stuff done, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. If you want a guy to say something a certain way, you read him the line the way you want him to say it. And it cuts a lot of work out, honestly. It's sort of dickish, but at the same time, it works.
You know, with Animal coming back at this point, and right before we did the show, I was skimming through the Observer going through this show, and the best line that I just skimmed, and it was like Dave Meltzer's just deadpan humor, was that the WWE is looking to bring back Tatanka, and there's just like this pause. It's like, he was pretty bad at 30, and now he's 40. And that was it. And then move on to the next news item.
Well, you know,
it seemed like there was this effort to bring back a lot of these veterans, and some curious decisions of which veterans to bring back.
I feel like it was the early days of what would become the traditional – what is now the traditional Legends program. Because remember over on Raw, we brought back Duggan for a little run with Shane, I think, at this point kicked his ass or something. A little bit later. Yeah, there was a direct thing. And obviously all of the Legend Killer stuff, like I know we brought in, I got to meet Kamala, which was super cool for Randy to kill one night leading into the Undertaker program. So yeah, it was there was a conscious decision down from Vince and Johnny, John Laurinaitis, to find places to use Legends where possible. It wasn't really a demand to shoehorn them in, but if there was a place we could use them, yeah. I did a lot of work on the Tatanka stuff. I did that whole series. They flew me out to frickin' Montana and South Dakota to do that whole series of vignettes, which is – we could do a whole nother podcast on that debacle.
That will be a future review away. Just the character of Tatanka.
Oh, man. You could – yeah, you should do character review aways.
Yeah, we've thought of doing more stuff like that, because we did like Kenta Kobashi last year and just
that
picked out
great.
Like three or four matches. And I kind of like the idea of doing that, because sometimes it's fun to do kind of themed shows versus just a straight up card.
No, and I hadn't seen two of those Kobashi matches. I can't. One was a tag, I think, and I can't remember the other one. But that was a great app. I think you guys should do that.
Yeah, perhaps that'll be our introductory for Kenta. Kenta fans. By the way, did you see the promo with him and Funaki that they threw up on the website on Sunday?
Kick your ass. I thought it was great.
Interesting use of Funaki. I'm curious to see where he goes, because thus far, it's like they're presenting him like a big deal.
Yeah.
It's not like he's just a guy they're throwing into developmental who has no history in the industry or anything. It's like he is being presented as a star.
And the thing, you know, because I read about it first, and the thing that stuck out for me was, you know, I was worried, oh God, they have him with Funaki, because the first thought with Funaki is the comedic character.
Yeah, but there wasn't comedy in it.
Yeah, no, he played it very straight, though still charming. I think it could work great, man. Like, I really do. I still, in the back of my mind, and this isn't an original thought, somebody on Twitter, I would give credit if I could think of it, said, boy, bringing Kenta in as a new Paul Heyman guy could be something special. And I really feel like that's the case. But I think this could work. I can't wait to see him on NXT.
Yeah, can you – like I've said this before, but man, by the end of this summer, you're going to have Pac, Adrian Neville, Tyson Kidd, Kevin Steen, Kenta, Prince Devitt, all on NXT.
Yeah. It's
like,
going to have a better
roster
in a lot of ways than the main roster.
Holy Christ. Like, it's going to be incredible to be watching as they – and just to watch some of these talents just navigate
just
that system.
Kenta, Devitt. Freaking give him 60 minutes. Give him an episode. Jesus Christ.
So Batista's with Eddie Guerrero in the locker room, and he begrudgingly says good luck to Dave, and Dave says the same to Eddie. And then they were pushing just this WWE Instant Access really, really hard. This was the WWE app of 2005, where all the winners of the last match would come in and sit down for a Q&A with Josh Matthews to ask the tough questions on WWE.com. And my goodness, this just felt like the shiny toy of the day in the WWE on this pay-per-view, because, man, did they pump this thing up hard.
Dude.
Instant Access.
Dude, it sucked, too. Like, I think partly so when I first started at WWE, Brian Gewirtz was gone. He was off writing a movie for WWE Films at that point. And Ed Koski was in charge. And that was a great working relationship. Brian came back and took an immediate dislike to me. And so for like four pay-per-views in a row, any Raw branded pay-per-view, because it was still, you know, the brand split at that point, I would get all of the post-show shit, and all of the interstitial things, and it was just the worst. I remember Taboo Tuesday. I had to grab Mick Foley, who was not working regularly, and, you know, he stumbles through the curtain after working his match. I think it was with Carlito, I'm not sure, and is just, you know, gasping for fucking breath. And here comes Smoking Al, which is what he called me, because he first met me. I was standing outside smoking a cigarette. Here comes Smoking Al. Hey, I need you to run back here. I need you to run back here. We've got, you know, the AD's freaking counting me in. And he's like, I can't breathe. Dragging him in there. Man, he hated me that night. God, it was the worst thing. And it was always stuff like that.
And this was also at a time where, I mean, obviously you could go to the website after, but they were really pushing the idea of kind of like this second screen experience. But this was in 2005, where that really didn't exist for a whole lot of people, that idea of, you know, having your laptop open or even having any kind of mobile device to be pushing this.
To give credit where it's due. And, you know, every wrong thing Vince does, I will, you know, shout about till my face is blue. I perhaps don't give him enough credit for the right things he does. I think Cord has talked about this on your show, but it was back during this period in a very nascent way that I feel like what is now the WWE Network was born. Because Vince, even back at this early days, and I mean, this is, I don't think I discovered YouTube yet at this point.
No, Vince, it wasn't really a thing till like early 2006 was the first time I ever found it.
Vince thought the web would ultimately be their distribution mechanism when TV dried up, and he knew it then. And that's, you know, I talk about how capricious Vince is, and working with him in sort of in terms of day-to-day creative, I have my complaints. But he's not been capricious on this. He has stuck to this vision for quite a long time now. And when I hear the talk of, oh, the losses, and, you know, they're cutting this kind of content, I don't think Vince is going to be quick to cut bait on the network idea, because I think he really does believe, almost in a legacy way, this is the future. And I think he's right. I think ultimately we're going to have a la carte television, and that is going to be the delivery mechanism. It's just, is WWE a little too early?
Yeah, and this was also that time, of course, we mentioned, you know, the move back to the USA Network, where they signed that deal, which was not as advantageous as the one they had at Spike. And that was when you first heard those rumblings of the idea that, you know, you can't necessarily just rely on a big television contract, that there seemed to be this extra added push. You remember, maybe it was very much hooked to instant access, but they had that idea of WWE Unlimited, where it was pretty much the app at that point, where they would encourage you during commercial breaks to go to the website, and they would shoot angles, and they would really push it hard for every break, and they would do stuff during those breaks. And I remember at that time trying to kind of balance the two of going, and then ultimately USA was like, hey, what the fuck?
No, intentionally, you know, I was sort of the key producer on the Mickey Trish angle. And one of the things, there was such an emphasis on this that Steph sort of wanted ideas for how to make this part of the habit. And I can't remember exactly what the piece of the story was, but it was during the period where Trish brought in her boyfriend or fiance, just the on-camera guy, and Mickey ended up destroying him utterly in one way or another. But we intentionally pitched it as we did some major plot point during one of those interstitials, during one of those periods, because we really wanted to, people cared about that story and they were tuning in to watch it. We really wanted to basically do an old school serialized cliffhanger where we cut off at the top of the commercial break and you had to push to the, not the network, whatever we were calling it at that point, to bring the viewers there. And as it turned out, it worked. I guess the page views were among the highest during sort of the early experimentation with that.
Next segment. And now I realize why it's been No Mercy 2005 that Alex Greenfield has wanted to go back here, because out comes Simon Dean on a segue, but he is not alone. He is accompanied by the one, the only, Big Dick Johnson.
Yes, he was.
With a giant plate of hamburgers, which would lead to a series, a show-long series of vignettes all night long. And Taz is quick to point out that Simon Dean may be a fitness guru, but Big Dick definitely is not a fitness guru. And Simon Dean gets on the mic, says how Houston was recently ranked the fattest city in America, points to the 20 double cheeseburgers he has brought out, and says, people who are gluttonous are pathetic, just like Bobby Lashley, and he promises he will eat all 20 of these if he loses tonight to Bobby Lashley, who had just been called up at this point, so very, very new to the roster, had come up from OVW, just looked like a freak at this time. And boy, this guy just screamed Vince McMahon guy. And, you know, he would ultimately, I mean, have his ups and downs with the company, but amazing that here we are almost, you know, 9 years after this show and Bobby Lashley remains a key part of the industry.
Yeah, and is a champion, and I'm so psyched with that. I'll tell a quick story about Lashley and how we got him and Raw didn't. There was a lot of, you know, engendered artificially by Vince, but there was a lot of competition at this point between Raw and SmackDown internally. So instead of trying to make the shows complement each other, we were like poaching talent from each other. And it was always, you know, SmackDown feeding Raw. This goes back to, you know, Paul Heyman's days running the show. Anyway, we're at a SmackDown taping, and Bobby was up from OVW just doing, you know, we used to bring talent up and they would work dark matches, and it just sort of gave them the sense of the live crowd. Bobby, you know, totally, utterly generic music hit because he had no entrance music, and David Lagana and I were standing off in the VOMs off to the side as he came in, and he came in and people got a look at his size and that body. And here's the Vince McMahon fetish actually being real. They fucking gasped. Like, it was a Lesnar like reaction, and he had nothing. It was just this little dark match with nothing in it. And we hit Vince, mostly Dave. I don't want to take any of the credit. Guys standing there and nodding, you know, agreeing. Dave got him signed to SmackDown, and we brought him up that night.
Wow.
Like, he worked again that night, and it was a SmackDown match. And that's how he got Bobby Lashley, because he had, and is demonstrating it now, so much upside. Like, you know, to rip off a JR-ism. But it was just great. And I think it pays off. I only just watched, because after I quit, I didn't watch for a couple of years. I just watched the John Cena-Bobby Lashley match from the Great American Bash after I left, I think 2007.
Which was a great build-up.
Fantastic, dude. It was perfect. Like,
it was like a big fight, which is how they promoted it. It was essentially very much copying UFC at the time, and it wasn't like your raw pro wrestling buildup. It was, and that, as I recall, that show did a surprisingly strong number with that buildup of your two big baby faces, kind of the main guy and the guy that was kind of in the Roman Reigns role at that time.
Our original long-term story projection at the time I left, like, I did a lot of work with Steph and Court, and like, we tried to set a good course, you know, for the show before I walked away during the, you know, I gave notice and I was still there for 3 weeks. We were like, let's try something big. And we had all of these long-term story projections. Bobby at the 2007 SummerSlam, like, we saw really, really big things in he and Kennedy at that point.
Yeah. I mean, Lashley was someone that they certainly saw a ton of potential in, and bringing him here into this match, I thought Taz really was great in this match, and I find whenever he can incorporate his judo background into explaining things and breaking things down, that's when I really enjoy Taz the most. I'm not as much into the comedy version of him, but when he is really into a match, it is so obvious, and he breaks things down, and I think he is a great color commentator at times. And in this match, he was just explaining just how hard it is to get a double overhook suplex that Lashley applied and throwing Simon Dean, and how much strength that takes, and just emphasizing those little things.
And it's true that at this point it's still true to this day that, you know, Bobby's not a great promo, and there's a cognitive dissonance between his speaking voice and his look. You know, they're like, these things are true. We were at this point, because he was fairly green in OVW, we at this point were having a bunch of people work with him, and specifically Taz and Arn Anderson were working with Bobby backstage every week at TV, trying to find his voice. So Taz was pretty invested at this point in Bobby Lashley's success.
Did you see the video on Impact? I think it was 2 weeks ago, where it's the taped segment of Lashley working out at the gym as MVP just cuts a promo with Lashley's back towards the camera.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, I didn't actually see the episode, but that I think got posted up on YouTube or something like that. And I saw a bunch of people tweeting about it. That's great presentation right there. That was really good.
Like, just excellent.
I'm actually just starting to tune in to TNA. I promised I would start watching it because MSL and I on an MLD said, I've tried to tune in to TNA and I've never gotten into it. And I wanted, you know, people talk about how they dislike it a lot. And the other side will often respond that they're WWE marks or whatever. But we sort of asked for people to tweet us sort of affirmative arguments, like, what do you like about TNA? And enough people gave me enough good arguments that I want to tune in. And a lot of people have told me these New York shows are the place to jump on. So, yeah.
The last month has been a real – there's a noticeable philosophical change to Impact ever since their pay-per-view. And I think going into that show, they had just hit rock bottom in terms of creative. And since that time, I find the show has been much more enjoyable. It's paced so much better. The crowds have largely been very good. And I think now is a good point to, you know, if you just are curious about watching something else, now is a good time, I think, to be watching Impact. You're getting a cool atmosphere at the very least. And I think they're clicking with some stuff right now, including Bobby Lashley, who's been presented very well as their champion, who just beats guys, and it's very simple, and it's been effective so far for the guy.
Nope. After we get off, I've got about 2 hours of work I got to do, and then I am going to. It's Tuesday as we tape this, and I will be watching TNA from last Thursday.
So Lashley pulls
out. If not the G1, and I got to ask you about that.
Oh, we will get to that 100%. Lifts out Dean's leg and then lifts him up for the Dominator, pins him in a minute 55, and they were pushing this as Bobby Lashley's pay-per-view debut. And also a great spot in this match was when Dean threw one of the hamburgers, and this distracted referee Jimmy Corderas, who had to go tend to the fallen hamburger.
Yeah.
As he hit Lashley with a plate to the head, and Lashley just no-sold it. So looking like the unstoppable force here was Bobby Lashley, pins him clean, and then this would lead to more comedy throughout the show as Simon Dean would be forced to eat all of these hamburgers. Then there was this random guy in the back who I had to look up. His name was Steve Romero, who was the backstage interviewer of the day.
That's right, Steve. He was, yeah. He was one of those dude bro guys. And you know that I'm probably the least sports fan of all people who have been involved with WWE ever. But and this is a widely known fact. I would get shit about it. It was part of my thing. It was my gimmick. I was the vegan at that point, non-sports guy. This dude would.
I think you and I would have gotten along great. I would have been your ally.
Excellent.
You and Court. Court probably would have hated me, actually, at the time. So Romero is with
Court hated you now. That's what he always tells me. What are you talking about?
You're breaking kayfabe right now. On the air, Alex. Come on. Jillian, with her mole, is with Steve Romero. Welcomes
Jade Girl. Let's put a mole on her.
This was just something else at the time. And JBL is asked about a potential Raw invasion tonight, which would be eventually setting up the Survivor Series.
Yeah.
And JBL says he has invited the B team and responds with, yum, yum, come get some, and calls Rey Mysterio a tortilla jumping bean. Rey walks in, speaks Spanish, and JBL informs him to speak English. And then Rey shows him one of his replica masks and offers it to JBL, who will want to hide his face tonight after he loses, and then proceeds to give it to Jillian. Very good backstage segment involving these two. And I always liked the idea of whether it was Eddie or Rey just speaking Spanish. I thought that really endeared themselves to that crowd that they were going after. And you actually saw it later on in the show with the Mexicools as well. You could definitely see that that was an audience they were heavily targeting, whether the Mexicools were the most endearing act to that audience or not.
Lagana started it, and Court and I supported it. And then when I took over the show, we continued it. We actively wanted to cater to minority audiences. And I can even tell you, I think it was that same, the house show loop that we were talking about earlier with Undertaker versus Eddie. We were on this house show loop in the South, and we saw, like, there were a lot of Latinos and a lot of black people in that audience. And we realized right away, and to his credit, Dave did, that this was an underserved audience by the two main shows. And we made it a priority to give them heroes and villains, you know, in King Booker and guys like that, and Mark Henry. Like, that became a priority for us.
There is Lashes on Instant Access. Teddy Long comes in, welcomes him to SmackDown. And then Tony Chimble's in the ring to announce the next match, a fatal four-way. And this thing got a gigantic reaction. Charmel comes out and is standing in Booker's corner, and she welcomes him and introduces him as being from Houston, Texas. So we got Chris Benoit defending the United States title against Christian, Booker T, and Orlando Jordan. And if you want to get really eerie, Alex, this pay-per-view took place in Houston, and the very next pay-per-view that the WWE would have in Houston was the night Chris Benoit did not show up for.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I did not know that. No, the story I was going to tell, and I mean, we've talked a little about the Benoit thing before, but this leading into this program is when I sort of started working with him on a regular basis, doing the comedy vignettes where Benoit would try and do things like, you know, make a cup of coffee faster than he beat Orlando Jordan and never quite be able to make it. And right. Chris and I got a really good relationship going. Because he liked the fact that I had confidence in him to do the comedy and not like over direct him or anything. And he hadn't had an opportunity through his whole career to really do comedy stuff. And they played well. The audience liked him. Like, we got some legitimate laughs for some of these little sketches we did. So I still, to this day, man, there's a real cognitive dissonance between the guy I knew and talked to, you know, practically every week, and this monster who killed his wife and child and then killed himself. Like, it still doesn't scan for me. And it's just the strangest thing because, you know, when we started talking about this show, obviously those Benoit memories came up. And I was thinking of him as, oh, here is this nice guy I worked with. Like, they're segmented from each other in my head.
Yeah.
You know, it's the weirdest psychological self-protection or who the hell knows. But it's the strangest thing because I didn't think about what he was. At first, I just tried to keep the No Mercy memories separate, I guess.
When you know, going back and watching a match with Chris Benoit, is it still kind of weird for you? Because I probably did not watch a Chris Benoit match for a good like 3 years or so after. And it was very weird for me for a long time. And I think at this time, I've kind of just separated the two. But it was very uncomfortable for me. I remember the first time we reviewed a show where there was a Benoit match on it. It was just very difficult to just focus on the match and not think of what's just, you know, clogging your thought process.
I remember the first match I saw of Benoit's after it happened was years later, maybe 2010 or 2011. And I sort of, it was a weird moment because I was watching a match on YouTube, and you know, when it ends, it comes up with the suggested links. And one of them was this Edge Benoit match that I remember being really good. And I clicked it without thinking about it. Do you know what I mean? It was just like this random moment where it didn't pop into my head. I was just like, oh, this is a good match. And I remember being taken, like, as soon as the screen changed, I was like, I'm watching a Chris Benoit match. It was, there's a level of weird that accompanies anything he does, good, bad, or indifferent. And this was good.
Yeah, a lot to this match. This was when Booker T was on his way to turning.
Yeah, we were just starting Lady Macbeth at this point.
Yes, yeah, which would ultimately, you know, come to fruition the next spring with the King of the Ring. This was also Christian's last pay-per-view before he would go over to TNA, where I remember his contract had expired, and there were whispers that he was going to show up at the TNA show, and I called him that week to try and get him to come onto the Law right after the TNA pay-per-view, knowing that would be the big news item. And I think I really caught him off guard, and he just said, "Oh, I can't come on Sunday. I'm building a house."
Ha.
And I was
raising, clearly.
Sunday night at 11:30 p.m. you'll be building a house, I guess. So anyway, and then amazingly, he showed up at the TNA pay-per-view.
Thing. Don't you do your construction at night?
Apparently so, yeah.
I read that on the internet, so I think it's true.
Because if you were to fall, and our healthcare system, you would want to go late at night where it's not as clogged.
That's right, because of your terribly clogged system. Oh my God, America kills me sometimes.
So lots of good stuff. This was probably, you know, some people's match of the night. Very good stuff here between everyone. We saw Benoit with a series of vertical suplexes to Jordan, including dropping him on top of Christian, working in all these spots. And they constantly were referring to Benoit and Booker T's best of seven series, which I have to imagine because they were going to go back to the best of seven series very soon after between the two of them. So kind of bringing that back to your memory.
I believe that. I'm not sure, actually. That wasn't me, but it was either as soon as which it was either Lagana or Court, and Court will skewer me for not remembering that. But somebody brought up that best of seven series from WCW, and it was just like, yeah, this is the thing. Like, this is so much programming. There's so much these guys can do together. Ah, it was great.
Finishing sequence comes when Benoit turns a Mahistal cradle into a crossface onto Christian. Jordan breaks it up, then Benoit applies a sharpshooter to Christian. He taps out for the win as Booker had taken Orlando Jordan to the floor. And really, this was the backdrop for afterwards, Charmel getting upset at Booker, saying that Benoit is not his friend and he made Booker T lose and he needs to start listening to her and not to this conscience he has. And then Michael Cole just started rattling off all these random names from Tiger Conway Sr., Danny McShane, Wahoo McDaniel, I am going to go out on a limb and assume that Michael Cole has never seen a Tiger Conway senior or junior match in his life, but tying into a Houston wrestling history to end this match. But a very good four-way here with Benoit retaining the title.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, the best of seven was what was to come. Oh, and the Christian story, no, it was interesting. I only worked with him one time. It was just a random – I was producing a promo that he was doing on – oh, just I think it was a Peep Show segment or something like that. Really good guy to work with, but you could tell. Pardon me, you could tell. I know you love that. You could tell that he was kind of done in his head. He was just sort of restless, I guess. And yeah. No, it was interesting.
Because
I didn't
because
get much
they had
from
that,
him, but he was a perfectly polite guy, but just not very invested.
If you go back to around the Royal Rumble that year, I think it was, where they started teasing Christian and John Cena, where Christian every week on Raw would be just taking shots at John Cena. And this went on for weeks and weeks and weeks. Cena finally got drafted over. So this was actually a program you were going to get to see. And they did a bit that summer. They did like a three-way on a pay-per-view with Cena, Christian, Jericho.
Well,
and
wasn't
then
one of them a Toronto or a Montreal show that he was just so fucking over? I swear I remember that like right before I started.
That's probably
Judgment Day, maybe?
I don't know if it was a pay-per-view, but there was that definitely sounds right that there was a Canadian show where they really just got into Christian so much. And then that SummerSlam, I remember a couple days before, Christian was up here for some media stuff, and I was just chatting with him like off-air. And just ask him, like, what's happening on SummerSlam? Like, he had been such a hot heel. And he's just like, they don't got anything for me. And he wasn't even on the card on SummerSlam. And it was really unfortunate because he had really gotten to a different level at that point. I think it was a fresh program with Cena. But Jericho was the guy they had pegged with Cena. And Christian was odd man out. And I think that really was it for him in terms of that hope of getting to that top position as a headliner at that point, and realized the writing was on the wall, unfortunately.
And it was a weird thing too. I mean, I know I'm segueing all over the place, and this is going to be the most
that's what people enjoy
podcast.
All these stories.
But it's funny because I did some of the just segment producing on the Jericho half of the Cena Jericho thing, and it's funny, like, they both knew it wasn't quite clicking. Like, it's a weird thing. Like, we did all those bits. We did the Rock versus Rap thing. We like all of these different things, and even both of the guys knew like something wasn't clicking about it. And I feel like it never did, but it's so, I just think it's an interesting and very much a product of wrestling that I haven't seen in any of the other mediums I've worked in. Like, they knew, and they were so desperately trying to get the crowd invested, and they just couldn't find the key. And just watching them go through that creative process, sitting and talking to each other about what would get people to invest. It was very early in my time there, and a really eye-opening experience to the creative process in wrestling.
Simon Dean is being forced to eat the burgers. He's just disgusted by this. And then in a really great line, I thought he tried to negotiate with Bobby Lashley, saying he would eat the meat, but please don't make me eat the extra carbs from these buns. I thought that was kind of funny.
I can't remember who did those. But yeah, they played surprisingly well.
There was a clip of Mr. Kennedy attacking Hardcore Holly with a microphone on SmackDown, and this led to Sylvain beating Hardcore Holly on TV. And we're going to get into Sylvain, which would, if Eddie Guerrero was number one on Alex's most enjoyable people to work for, Sylvain might be the Baltimore.
He is on
that scale.
He is a zero on the Baltimore 1-10 scale.
So Kennedy is out, does his entrance with the mic from the ceiling, taking on Hardcore Holly. And this challenge was made on WWE.com. And Holly essentially here attacked him with a drop kick and then the heat switch with a sucker punch as Holly was tossed to the floor. Kennedy was just jacked at this point, just a massive guy if you compare him to today. Holly comes back with a pair of big chops. Kennedy comes back attacking the shoulder. And then Holly blocks a spin kick, hits a big boot to Kennedy. Kennedy stops Holly on the top, hits his rolling fireman's carry off the second turnbuckle and gets the win at 8:46, announces himself as the winner. And Holly's ribs are hurt after the match, doesn't want help from the officials. And Sylvain runs down, the SmackDown fashion consultant, and attacks Holly at ringside, stomps on his injured ribs, and Taz concludes that Holly's pride has been broken from this loss and the attack, which would lead to Sylvain and Holly coming out of this. But as you mentioned, Alex, Kennedy, really, this was a time when he was on the fast track on SmackDown.
No, Ken was very much on the fast track at this point. And I have literally blocked from my memory. I know I produced most of this fucking Sylvain Holly stuff, such as it was. And everybody knew it was a fail from the beginning, and Vince was so into it, and I think it was a rib, dude. I really do. I think the whole existence of Sylvain Grenier was a rib on Court Bauer and me and David Lagana and everybody involved with SmackDown.
What was it about Sylvain that was difficult to work with?
Oh, man, the most disingenuous guy, the first guy who would complain over your head about absolutely everything. If you wrote a promo out for him, he says, it's no good, write it again. If you give him bullet points to extemporize, always a laugh. Why, you know, write it out for me. He complained literally every match we ever had him work. He complained about guys being too stiff, which is one of the ribs on him from putting him with Bob Holly, obviously. he was awful. And then just from, you've produced people, so you know this, shoot scheduled for 1 p.m. right after the agent meeting. He wanders in at 3 complaining about the traffic from the airport when you know he's fucking been there for a couple of hours. You know, just the most exasperating piece of talent I've ever worked with in any medium.
You know, what's funny is that when they brought him in, one guy who I really thought was going to amount to a lot more than he did was Rene Dupree. Like, he was very green when he came in, very young. But I just thought, man, by the time this guy is 25, 26, I just saw him as being, you know, someone that could really be somebody at that point in time. And unfortunately, they broke up the team and he just never really got over as a singles performer, had his own issues at the time.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there were some personal issues, which I think was the big stymie, because there was talk about bringing him in or something, and that case broke right around this period. I wasn't directly involved in it, but I know that that was on the mind of people when talk of him came up.
All right, we continue on here with Charmel is in the back yelling at Booker as Booker or Benoit is doing an interview for WWE.com. And this was great. It was like, the reason Benoit is on Instant Access is because he's the winner and you're the loser. And
on says, the main show.
And it was Booker's night to shine here in his hometown, but his friends stole this moment. Kennedy then walks into the shot, does his broadcaster voice to announce himself winning in his first pay-per-view, says he is a winner, leaves the shot, which was became a staple for Kennedy backstage promos, and then returned to call Booker a loser and walks away. And Charmel stops Booker from going after Kennedy and says, your problems aren't with Ken Kennedy or Chris Benoit. They are with yourself. Charmel
so
was like,
great.
Charmel was really something, and not like she had a background, you know, when she was in WCW. I mean, she never spoke or anything, but man, when she was thrown into this role, as much praise as King Booker got, she was just equal to that
together,
act.
They were my champions, like, and then, and their chemistry with Regal and Finley, you know, the two fighting members of the Black Guard, they were just, I can't speak highly enough about working with them, and just the best. Like, I once called Booker, this is about a year later during the King Booker stuff, and to talk about ideas, and he was like, Alex, I'm the easy guy, just don't even talk to me about the ideas until they're ready, tell me where to be and I'll figure it out. And he did every time. The English accent was all Booker. Charmel's wave was all Charmel. Like, their chemistry together was just what makes working in wrestling more fun than I complain about the bad parts a lot. That's the part that's more fun than anything, when someone takes a raw chunk of idea and turns it into something special.
Yeah. But, when you guys are doing just these marathon sessions of pre-tapes and all that stuff, it seems like those guys like Booker T are the ones that, you know, if we're going to have to be doing all of these, those are the kind of talents you want around, that are going to have fun with it. They understand what the gig is and are not going to further add to the stress that's probably on everybody who are under the gun to get all this stuff done. JBL and Rey Mysterio was next. This was, JBL had the long run with the title up until WrestleMania that year. Rey was coming off the feud with Eddie Guerrero. And Taz explains how Rey Mysterio was a big fan of Mil Máscaras and got to face Mil Máscaras in one of his last matches, which was telling because this was 9 years ago and Mil Máscaras has wrestled a match this year. a wrestling retirement true and true with Mil Máscaras. Very long headlock spot by JBL. There were constant cuts to Jillian's mole. Rey comes out.
Vince and Kevin, you have no idea. Because, whoever's producing a given segment or whoever's talent is in the ring is on cans next to Vince in Gorilla. Largely with me so that he could yell at you whenever anything went wrong. I don't know about others. Their talk about the mole was just... It was awesome, and it became a rib on Jerry Briscoe, who apparently has a famously weak stomach for gross-out stuff.
Yeah.
So they would pull, press whatever button it is so that – because he's sitting over timing the show through in Gorilla the whole time. He and Kevin would get on and just discuss the mole in the most vile detail, trying to make Gerald Briscoe sick. And that's what the purpose of the mole was. And dude, when we bit the mole off her face with Boogeyman, he threw up.
There's a show I want to see. Is Vince McMahon and Kevin Dunn just having a few beers on the corporate jet and just chatting about what works in wrestling? That to me would be what a conversation. Like, these two feel like Kevin Dunn is like the ultimate enabler, I feel.
But it's not really... It's an echo conversation. It's a mirror conversation, because what Kevin does, what his jujitsu at which he is a red belt, is taking things that come from Vince and reflecting them back at Vince in such a way that he thinks they were Kevin.
Well, it's a skill. I guess it's a skill if you've gotten this many years out of it. So the match here with these two, Rey comes out, outruns JBL to try and blow him up was the strategy. And then Rey hits a bulldog off the apron. JBL then comes back, pulls his leg out, and crashes him on top of the steps. JBL gets the advantage, hits a follow-away slam off the second turnbuckle. He's going for pinfalls. Rey continually kicks out. And then Rey makes his comeback here, hits the Bronco Buster. Jillian gets on the apron. JBL nearly runs into her, and... there is a moonsault to JBL for a near fall. Rey hits the 619, goes for the West Coast pop, but JBL ducks it and comes off the rope, hits the clothesline from hell, and pins Rey at 13 minutes, 24 seconds. I really like the finish.
Yeah,
this.
That finishing sequence was so rad, right? I didn't see I was there, and I didn't see it watching it the other day. I didn't see the clothesline coming at all. I thought it was a great piece of illusion making. You know, they always had great chemistry together. Whoever went over, like, they got along real well. And, they barely work anything out before they go out there.
So what do you recall in terms of plans for Ray? Because this was after the Eddie feud, and this was also before, you know, all the stuff going into WrestleMania 22 would become even a thought at this point. So Ray was kind of in limbo at this point.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I was wondering about that myself, and I start to worry that there wasn't a big plan for Ray at this point.
Yeah, that's how I kind of felt on this show.
Because, you know, he obviously, with the tragic events a month later, became kind of the focal point of the show in an emotional way. But I couldn't tell you. I cannot for the life of me remember what the sort of long-term planning for Ray was.
Retirement match with Mil Máscaras, WrestleMania 22.
We could do that every year, the streak of retirement matches.
So then we got a video on the Undertaker Orton's feud, plural, because this match would involve Cowboy Bob Orton.
Would it ever?
I've always had a soft spot in my heart for Cowboy Bob Orton. And when he showed up at SummerSlam and they did the double Orton pose after beating Undertaker, I remember watching the pay-per-view and myself and Jason Agnew just howling at that visual of the two of them posing together. Because Bob Orton is just – he did a long interview years ago with Dan Lavransky, and we'd always get liners from these guys at the end. It's just like, hey, Cowboy, just, you know, you're listening to the law, however you would like to do it. He's like, all right. Hey, this is the Cowboy, baby. And you're listening to the law. It was just the most Cowboy –
fantastic.
It was awesome.
It doesn't
like,
surprise
just
me
awesome.
At all. Dude, he was so much fun. One of my favorite times the whole time I was at WWE, it was me, Chris DeJoseph, Chris Benoit, and Cowboy Bob Orton. We were in Austin, Texas, and we went to the bar, ordered a pizza, and just went and sat outside. And Cowboy Bob started telling stories from the old days. And time went away, and it was 3 a.m. and Chris Benoit was sound asleep with his head on his chest. And DJ and I are just sitting there at the learning tree in rapt attention. He was just a really, really, you know, I did a lot of the dopey supernatural bits because I came out as sort of a horror writer. All of the weird, you know, Bloody Bob showing up in the mirror behind Randy and shit like that was all me. And, so I got to work with him a good bit. Just the best guy and absolutely game for anything. Like, he was having so much fun being there. And I feel like Randy raised his game as a performer with it. And, dude, only guy I ever met who could, on any conversation, break up The Undertaker. Just getting dying laughing and seeing The Undertaker laugh, even as a jaded former employee, it's really incongruous, dude. Like, it's a strange thing to see. But Bob Orton could do it.
Was there any truth to the idea of also the positive of bringing Cowboy on the road was someone that Randy could travel with as well and just kind of, you know, keep him in check because, you know, the sky was the limit for Randy Orton, with the limit being himself at the time.
I mean, it's an interesting thing because even at the time, the sort of whispered talk in the writer's room is this a way to keep Randy in check?
Right.
But we'd never heard that. And I feel like the idea of Bob coming in was generated from creative. Like, I think that was it was before I got there that the idea was on the table, but I think it came from Lagana or somebody on the creative team. So it's not as though, you know, John Laurinaitis and Vince said, let's get Cowboy. God damn it, pal. Let's get Bob on the road. Keep that kid down.
Right. Well, Cowboy Bob was dressed for his pay-per-view best here with a button-up shirt and jeans as he got set for this handicap casket match with The Undertaker. The Druids came out bringing the casket leading to The Undertaker's entrance, and they got the heat on Undertaker almost right away.
Literally.
Yeah, well, that would be to come. Cowboy hit him with a low blow. Taker came back, got the advantage, beating down on both. And they kind of just worked in all these clever spots. They worked in there was a fire extinguisher that Cowboy got on the floor. Taker hit him with a big boot, dropping the extinguisher, sent Randy into the casket, but you had to get both guys into the casket. There was a chair shot to the back, and then Undertaker applied, with all due respect to the man, one of the worst triangles you are ever going to see. this would not be Wei Ting bronze medal approved, this particular triangle. But Bob is out from this triangle. The crowd is really into this. They're all chanting rest in peace. Orton holds the door open. All three are essentially in the casket. And then Orton, Randy, and Undertaker get out with Bob just trapped in the casket. Taker hits a low blow to Randy. Randy cuts him off with a clothesline. They continue fighting. And then out of nowhere, the casket opens as Taker is ready to throw Randy in, when there is Cowboy ready with the fire extinguisher, sprays him in the face. And then Taker, in getting this spray in the face, turns around into the RKO, and they're rolling Taker over to the casket. The crowd is freaking out that the Undertaker is going to lose this match, and then at the last minute grabs Cowboy by the throat. Randy then attacks him with the fire extinguisher. Taker goes into the casket, and they close it and lock the casket shut as Randy and Cowboy pull off the win here in the casket match. I thought they got very creative here with what they were given here, of working a lot of smoke and mirrors, literally, yeah, in this particular match, and got a pretty good match out of this. And the crowd, they really took to this match as one of the key parts of the show.
No, they totally did, didn't they? I mean, it's one of the reasons you get that cruiser match next. It wasn't a lack of faith in Nunzio. I don't mean that. And Juventud. It was, you needed a buffer because we knew, like, you could just feel there was this sense from Taker and Randy that they hadn't reached what they could reach at Mania, or, you know, on the house show loops, or that they'd never gotten to where they could be. And having the toy of Bob being able to be there let them just get so creative inside the contours of the match.
So then we get the post-match angle. They roll the casket to the entrance, and Randy...
Oh, can I give you one side story? Because it just occurred to me what happens with Ray. There is no plan for the table on Ray, and at some point, it was late in the Undertaker-Randy program, just on a random night, we had a two, maybe three segment Randy Orton-Rey Mysterio match, and it blew the roof off the place. Like, they were so creative. They were great together. And I remember after that match, I said to Steph and Vince, on the plane or at the hotel, that's going to be a WrestleMania main event one day. Not thinking it would be WrestleMania 22, you know, in the three-way.
Right.
But they were like, yeah, that was really good, right? And the idea was definitely going to be a long-term program with Orton and Ray. So everything changed.
And at this point, too, Batista, yeah, this was before... I remember, like, he injured himself and then kept working for a number of months. And I think he got, like, another injury.
This was before either of those things happened.
Oh, so this was before
right around
the House of Cards was going to fall.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, no. I mean, we were psyched. He was going to come. We'd pretty much settled on Taker Dave at Mania at that point. What would be the 23 match?
It's such a blur when you go back, Alex. But when you start,
Batista would have been the uninterrupted champion going in, and the rub would have been streak versus title.
Like, it's amazing when you kind of just catalog all these, like, things you guys were throwing. Like, Top Star gets injured, out for months. The unfortunate passing of Eddie Guerrero. Yeah. Randy Orton got popped for, like, a violation, I think, going into WrestleMania or coming out of WrestleMania the next year.
Well, the timing there being a thing.
Amazing how those things work out.
Strange, isn't it?
But it's pretty incredible when you look at, like, this was all stuff affecting your top players and just the scrambling of the deck that you guys were forced to pretty much be in a regular habit of doing.
And it was, I feel like it was a little worse for SmackDown. I mean, you remember, like, I always talk about I am the writer, the head writer of the worst pay-per-view of all time. A lot of that self-deprecating humor, a lot of it wasn't my fault. You know, two of my primary players get popped on wellness violations. Like, it just, Lagana towards the end of his run and me all through mine were just snake bit with injuries of our top guys. And I don't know if it was, you know, is it a byproduct of the working style? I don't think so. I think we were just randomly unlucky in losing a lot of key players right when we needed them.
And today there are no wellness violations, ever.
It's strange, isn't it?
Very strange. So the post-match, Randy is, he brings the casket up to the entrance, is attacking it with an axe. as Cowboy brings out a giant canister of gasoline, appropriately labeled gasoline, pours it all over the casket.
Gotta respect your audience, pal. Come on.
Yep. Nobody is batting an eye that maybe someone should step in here.
Not a soul.
Oh, what could he be doing? Is that real gasoline? We're going to find out.
What could possibly go wrong, John? Come on.
They light it on fire. Cole and Taz are selling just this shock here that a man has died. The WWE crew finally comes in. They replay a supposed death on live pay-per-view, and the highlight being a cut to a woman in the audience who is just like hands over her mouth in shock, looking like she is about to cry.
Right? Like, how do they find them? It's amazing.
It was unreal. And then they cut to Cole and Taz, and my God, did these two have
to... So somber.
Like Taz was about to smirk. Like, he looked like, okay, this has hit my bullshit factor too much. Michael Cole is selling this as this is a legitimate tragedy. And unfortunately, when you do, like, angles like this are very tough for wrestling fans to digest. I think even tougher when the show has to continue and we have to segue to a cruiserweight title match as they say, well, it's time to get back to business.
I know, it sucks, right?
Like, I know there's some creative liberty with the Undertaker character, but these ones are tough when we're supposed to think a man just died.
Dude, it just gets worse from there. Like, there's the casket opening while it's smoldering, and then all the supernatural weirdness. Ah, oh, dude, it was those were my salad days. You have me as a guest.
This was actually just a month or two before they would start those infamous Tim White storylines.
Oh, God, those were great.
There was a pay-per-view where you legitimately went off thinking the man had killed himself. And it was not that tongue-in-cheek either. Like, the promos would eventually get to be high comedy, essentially. But the first one, you thought this guy like blew his head off or something. And again, cut to the next match.
I thought those were so fantastic, man. A lot of that was the work of Christopher DeJoseph and Chris Roach, who's gone on to run Big Brother and wrote the movie with Liam Neeson last fall nonstop. So a very good creator. He did a lot of the work on these, and they were just Mr. White, I don't think that's wise. I loved them. I thought they were great. Had not a doggone thing to do with them, but you know, who am I to judge?
So the buffer match, as Alex alluded to, Nunzio accompanied by Big Vito. Was this pre dress or post dress for Big Vito? Because he was just in regular gear here in Nunzio's corner.
I don't think. Oh, gosh, what was it? No, he was not in the dress yet. He was about to come out to Nunzio shortly hereafter, I think.
Okay. So Nunzio was defending
come
the Cruiserweight. he defended the Cruiserweight title against Juventud. Juventud, he won a Cruiserweight Battle Royal on Velocity the prior week to get this big title shot. And just this literally was the death spot. They had to follow a death as they got the crowd ready here for the main event. And to their credit, I thought had a pretty good 6.5-minute match here. I mean, Juventud Guerrero, for all the knocks this guy gets, extremely talented performer and someone that just kind of the victim of his own problems, essentially, in this business. Anyway, they fought to the top, both dived off, landing on the mat chest first. Nunzio turns over, tries for a two count. Taz mistakes psychosis for super crazy at ringside as Hoovy then hits a shining wizard. Nunzio misses the Sicilian slice off the second turnbuckle. And then Vito grabs the leg of Hoovy on the apron, goes for a sunset flip, but then leg scissors Vito off the apron. And then Nunzio rolls over for a two count after a top rope crossbody from Hoovy. Hoovy gets up, hits a Northern Light suplex, but rolls through, lifts him up for the Hoovy driver and wins the title at 6:38. And then the Mexicools all celebrate. And in an added touch, Hugo Savinovich interviews the Mexicools, and they all speak in Spanish with Super Crazy adding that your ass is grass for the crowd. And the Houston crowd really reacted to this.
Yeah, no, they got over in a way that was stunning. My one of my writing partner friends, after I was at WWE, he got a lark to apply for a job, and I was like, "Well, one of the things you're going to have to do is come up with a storyline and send it in. That's part of the hiring process." And he did it with the Mexicools. And it was not borderline racist. So it was the weirdest thing. Like, I was always a little, you know, and maybe I'm too PC or whatever. I was always a little uncomfortable with the stereotype of the angle, but people loved it. And the Latino community loved it. Like, it got over far more than anybody, or certainly than I anticipated it would.
Taz just went on this random discussion about what the Mexicools are going to drink to celebrate this title discussion, this title win. And just this discussion just went on for a good 2 minutes of Taz and Michael Cole discussing a variety of drinks.
Bearing in mind that a man just burned to death.
They're over it. They're over it. You know, they're celebrating the Undertaker's
life.
No,
I remember being backstage at this point, and we're watching, you know, there's a monitor backstage where a bunch of the boys and the writers, stand around and watch the show as it goes on. And we were just like, the commentary was killing us. And I think Booker at that point was sitting backstage doing alternate commentary. Like, he would call the matches and stuff. And he was six times as hilarious. I feel like his main problem as a commentator was Vince reined him in from just doing what he does, which is a one-man call of the entire thing. He was the color man. He was play-by-play. And it was fucking hilarious.
If you go back, I put the clip at the end of Review of Raw of Booker T on the backstage pass.
I listened to it this morning, man. Oh, he's so great. Well, you see, it's got a potential fine of 2 to 10, but they're probably going to reduce it. And he's so great. Booker's awesome.
Even the part where Riley's like, well, she also is facing a charge of resisting arrest. And Booker just blows him up. Oh, that'll be dropped. That's just an innocuous charge. That'll be dropped. Like, just the expert. Booker T, legal expert, has lots of interest.
Didn't Brian say, like, they should do a Judge Joe, you know, Judge Wapner, Judge Judy type show with him? I think that would be fantastic. Easy lots fix for the network.
Booker T is a great guy to use for, you know, just – various segments. I think there's a lot you can use with a Booker T, and I howled watching back on that clip because I was getting tweets as we were doing the show just about Booker T. Everyone was talking about Booker T on Backstage Pass, and first I was just stunned that this many people were watching Backstage Pass, but with good reason here for Booker T. So final segment here with Lashley and Simon Dean. He has ate all 20 cheeseburgers, but Lashley informs him, no, he has only ate 19. He has one more. And this is the coup de grace, as Simon Dean will take no more, and he proceeds to go to the washroom and loudly vomit. Boy, whose mind did this come from, Alex?
I am going to deny all culpability. They kept me away from comedy because I am not right for that. I'm pretty sure this wouldn't be core. I mean, look, this has to spring from the mind of Vince in some way or another. I just have no evidence to give you. But I don't know where this came from. And I'm going to hold to that story.
So main event time, Batista and Eddie Guerrero for the world title. For whatever reason, I watched this on the network, and Eddie had to come out to a altered theme song, which wasn't his theme at this time. So I don't know what the rights was there. They also, throughout this version of the network show, I looked this up.
It's funny because I watched it on an illegal service called YouTube. And I had no idea the theme changed. That's funny.
Well, that's pretty telling right there that you could easily access this on YouTube.
There's a lot of telling there.
So crowd is very hot at the start, chanting for Batista. The early part was just essentially a wrestling match where both are abiding by the rules with Eddie Guerrero. He's going to wrestle this match straight up. And it was Batista just using his strength to thwart Eddie at every opportunity.
Turn.
Yeah, and just Eddie, you can see the frustration growing and growing. And Batista locks on a headlock. Very good storytelling, I thought, throughout this. And Guerrero grabs a chair at ringside, but then throws it to the floor. And this is upsetting Batista, thinking that, you know, Eddie's going to use nefarious means to try and take his title away from him. So Batista grabs him by the throat, starts lecturing him. But then Batista gets draped on the top rope, neck first. And this allows Batista to hit a frog splash for a two count and starts working on the lower back of Batista throughout the match. And Guerrero, he's constantly doing things. Like, he grabbed the tag rope, but then tossed it to the floor.
Yeah.
And as Alex kind of outlined, kind of like the inner battle of Eddie Guerrero, that this is his go-to kind of MO, so to speak, but would constantly just have this battle within himself of whether to cheat or not. And then it leads to the spot where Guerrero, in avoiding Batista in the corner, runs backwards, knocking out Nick Patrick. And this time a smirk comes over Guerrero's face.
It's like getting handed to him by fate. Ah, I thought Eddie is so great here, man.
So he grabs the chair on the floor. Batista is selling a DDT, but again, Guerrero hesitates and decides against using it. And this time it backfires because Batista fires up, makes a comeback, spears Eddie. Then Guerrero blocks a Batista bomb, lifts him up for a spine buster. But then Batista comes off the top and like elbow drops Eddie's ankle out of nowhere. And Guerrero comes back, hits the three amigos, misses Batista off the top as he was going for a frog splash, but then rolled through as Batista got out of the way. And Batista just popped up, hit the spine buster, and pinned Eddie clean. 18 minutes, 40 seconds they went, and then they begrudgingly, or at least on Eddie's part, shook hands after the match and playing up that Batista should not trust Eddie Guerrero, but retains the title here. So this was very much just kind of pushing that this story of Eddie Guerrero. You knew this program was likely to continue.
Oh, yeah, and this was, I mean, this was going to carry us for a long time, at least through December was the sort of projected blow-off. But there was even talk about some kind of mega fucking blow-off at the Rumble, you know, that much later. And, you know, Eddie really wanted to wrestle with the decision to be bad. Like, he wanted no other avenues open to him. He wanted to force himself. He wanted to force the character into one of those positions that there just is no other choice. I think this match is really undervalued, man. I think Eddie's work in it. And Dave's just the subtle way he keeps giving Eddie opportunities. The amount of times that Batista gives him his back, and Eddie just gives that great little subtle, I could stab him here or not. I think it's just a really good match.
Yeah, and you had, you know, the idea, yeah, he lost clean in this match, but also you have the story that, you know, the old Eddie Guerrero probably would have won the title.
Yep.
So there was that reason to progress this and want to push Eddie more towards going back to that villain character. So some very good storytelling, some good highlights on this particular show. I enjoyed the four-way. Up until The Undertaker got torched, I thought they did a very good job in the casket match and also enjoyed the main event. So this was kind of one of those hidden shows when you go back and watch, and there was a lot to take from it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we were really proud of it after it was over. I mean, there was some silly stuff, but ultimately it paid off, I think. I think it's one of my favorite shows I worked on in the whole time I was there.
Now, when I contacted Alex to come on this show, I said, you know, if you got like an hour free to do the show, that'd be great. We are at 90 minutes right now. Alex, barring any commitments you have right now, we can rapid fire go through some of these questions.
I am sitting outside on a gorgeous summer day doing absolutely nothing I should. Let's go for it.
That's what we like here. A huge draw here on the message board, Alex. We got inundated with questions for you. So we'll go through these. Hopefully some of these we haven't answered in the past. We can keep them brief if you have. But we'll start off with Christian Small. With this, this would end up being the last pay-per-view for the late Eddie Guerrero. I wanted to ask about Alex's relationship with him, which we kind of went over. How was he during this time where he was said to be very hurt? Also, is there any truth to the rumor he was going to win the world title right before he passed away? Thank you very much, guys. Looking forward to the review.
No on any plans for him to win the world title. I mean, I think everybody anticipated that at some point in his career, Eddie would win the championship again. I mean, he was sort of one of those top tier players that you would just assume that was the case, but there were no plans on the table for it. My relationship with Eddie, we covered. And what was the third part?
The last part was, just in terms of Eddie's health at this point.
Oh, we knew his knees were hurting. But to the point that, like, I think there was talk of surgery, and he just didn't want to do it. He wanted to rehab it on his own, but there was no, it came as a total shock. There was no indication outwardly that Eddie had some lingering illness.
You would also think if the guy was really hurting, like the WWE side, the creative staff, that would be the people he would least want to know in, right? That he would hurt. You would want to almost keep that quiet and just, you know, maybe share it amongst like your close circle. Matt in suburban Detroit wants to know, was there any consideration for Chris Benoit or Christian getting the world title at any point during this period, as you can recall?
No.
We go on over to Kevin from Danville, Illinois. Was there ever a thought to give it to having a WCW-ECW takeover of SmackDown? And why was the television title dropped? I don't even recall the television title being activated.
Yeah, I don't think it ever was during my time there. I never remember there being a TV title.
No.
As to talk of a WCW, ECW, New Japan, All Japan, NOAH attack on the halls of SmackDown, no. That never
you got
came
the
up.
The Blue World Order. That was the, yeah, that was the takeover.
There's three episodes with the Blue World Order, and SmackDown's part in the ECW, the horrible assault on ECW's character. No, I mean, there was never consideration of that. We did, as part of our plan, remember I've talked to you before about how when I first took over SmackDown, we made a pretty, hard sell pitch to try and get Kevin Dunn not to be our executive producer, to move Tim, whose last name I never remember, who was one of our directors, up into being our executive producer. One of the ideas on the table was to have, because, JBL was hurt at this point, and we were just thinking about bringing him back into commentary. The other thought on the table was to have him, times were tough, and he was going to buy SmackDown from Vince.
Oh, there you go.
As sort of a raison d'etre for why the whole show would – the feel of the show would change, because it's this horrible human being running things. But that didn't come to pass.
We'll go to Randy here. We'll go to one of his questions here. At around this time, Paul Mercannon quit mid-international tour because he couldn't handle the bullying. This was also around the time that Miz was being forced to change in janitor's closets. Were WWE management and creative aware of locker room issues? Did they care? Did they, in fact, encourage the behavior of people like JBL to weed out those who couldn't handle it?
No. I mean, a more complicated answer. We knew about the Paul Mercannon thing. I only heard about the Miz broom closet thing years after the fact, well after I quit and everything. But the Palmer Cannon thing we knew about. I once asked JBL sort of point blank. I was like, were you hazing him any harder than you hazed me, when I was coming in? Because he gave me, overwhelming piles of shit. And he said, not really. So, I mean, it's an interesting question. I was bummed about that. Like, we had big mid-card plans. I don't want you to think anything, monstrous, but big mid-card plans for Palmer, and thought he was a fun plot device that we could use. So it was a bummer for us when he went away. We really were, in the same way you were sort of saying, of course you wouldn't tell someone you were injured on creative because creative might scale you back, right? We weren't really told too much about internal locker room. I think feel like we were insulated from internal locker room politics, except sort of big things that filtered up, like somebody quitting.
Yeah, not different from any kind of work environment where you're going to have management and employees, where, there's stuff that's going to happen amongst employees that you don't want getting up to your head office, essentially. And there's a reason, unless maybe Sylvan is your pipeline, maybe.
Which isn't to say, I think there's too much of hazing in that culture. I think there's too much. I mean, it is like a bunch of macho dick measuring, right? And earning your place and all of that. I didn't really earn my place. I aggressively went after becoming the head writer of a show. I sort of took the rings, sometimes in a really dickish way. That's shit that I have to own, but I'm a believer in letting the talent rise, and the seniority system feels overrated to me, and I think that's part of what leads to the level of hazing that there was, at least in my time there. For what it's worth, I understand that there's a lot less of it now.
Yeah, you really don't hear those stories all too often, especially not to that degree where someone's on the brink of quitting or anything like that. It seems like it's a very much, at least toned down locker room at this point, because those are the kind of stories that do tend to permeate out if they do occur. Gaurav from India. Michael Cole and Taz were fantastic together. Cole doesn't get enough credit, but I think he's great at doing play-by-play. He has the same passion that Jim Ross has. It's all the continuous network plugging these days that's made everyone sick of the guy. I want to ask Alex about how Michael Cole was behind the scenes. Was he respected by everybody? Do you feel that he doesn't get enough credit?
He's I'm not a huge fan of Cole's commentary. I like Cole, the guy who, when I knew him, was this totally misanthropic, curmudgeonly, like never had a positive word to say about anything and was hilarious for it. Like he was just like grumpy all the time. And his interplay with Taz, who would be the same way, but would sort of jolly it up to fuck with Michael. They were fun guys to work with. So yeah, I find Michael's play by play. Part of it is the problem of when they did that heel run with him a couple of years ago. I lost confidence in him in sort of a creative way, and I'm not over him being sort of heelish anymore. What I wouldn't give for JR and Mauro Ranallo.
Yeah, I think Michael Cole is a very competent announcer. Yeah. I think it's when you have that template where Jim Ross could take things into that next gear to really get that drama across. I think that's where Michael Cole lacks. I think that's probably very much across the board for most announcers. I mean, Jim Ross had a very unique skill set in order to take things. Like, can you imagine Jim Ross after Heyman cut that promo on Monday?
God,
and just
right?
The hard sell, Cena, Lesnar, 4 weeks from now. How, you know, yeah. Just going off the air, and you would just have this such a sense of urgency when Jim Ross, he would pick his spots. He knew when to do the big sell and when to lay low for things.
You're absolutely right. And just the instinct of where to back out and all that. I know it's not the topic of the official topic of the podcast, but just a few words on that fucking Heyman promo, which is definitely the best thing since Mark Henry's retirement on WWE television. And I just thought was a remarkable piece of old school Barker promo cutting. That cut through the clutter. Like, it wasn't some inside CM Punk pipe bomb. It wasn't a big swerve like Henry's retirement. Just in terms of a simple promo, I thought he did a masterwork. It was a masterclass in how to just completely own an audience. And I'm so psyched for SummerSlam because of that.
I bet he's had that promo in his head for months.
Yeah.
Knowing this was the direction, this was the promo. And, you know, to be honest, like, we had such high expectations of, you know, Cesaro being paired with Heyman. Heyman didn't really have a meaningful promo to cut during that entire period with Cesaro. There was no kind of program that you could sink your teeth into that Heyman could. It was essentially him coming out. It was all very good.
It was reminding him about his client, Brock Lesnar.
That was it.
And here was a reason to have him on the show. Did he have an impact in anything to do with Cesaro?
Nothing. In fact, I would say Cesaro is colder today than he was at WrestleMania. I think that's pretty unanimous at this point. And, you know, it was just not. And I don't blame it on Heyman being attached with him. I blame it on just there was nothing for Cesaro. There was no kind of money promo for Heyman to cut during that whole time period. That Monday must have been a breath of fresh air. We're giving you the mic for 10 minutes to sell the main event of SummerSlam.
And it was just, I mean, it was phenomenal. It was up there. And I mean, look, history will be the judge. It's when we watch it 3 months from now, 6 months from now, does it still hold up? But right now it's feeling like Austin 316 and the pipe bomb. Like, it's just such a wonderfully crafted work from his diction to his colloquialisms. Like, it was just a really, it was a great wrestling performance.
We go to Cody from Rockland, Maine. Just one question for Mr. Greenfield. How hard was Vince McMahon laughing during Chris DeJoseph's cameo with Simon Dean? Thanks in advance from a longtime MLW VIP member.
Three snorts and a chuckle.
Exactly. Down to the exact chuckle.
Yes.
Dwayne writes in from Ireland. It was what it was in reference to No Mercy 2005.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's a tough crowd sometimes.
I know. I fear the law pro boards.
You should see what they say about me. The only thing stopping this pay-per-view from being completely forgettable is the fact that it was the last Eddie Guerrero match on pay-per-view. From revisiting the show, I have to wonder why the Undertaker-Orton feud was stretched out so long. The feud peaked at WrestleMania with a great match, but each match that followed got progressively worse. Oh, this one's just digging the knife in deep, Alex.
I know, you're killing me. Jeez.
Until the dull Hell in a Cell match at Armageddon.
I'm actually kind of with him on the dull Hell in the Cell. Like, it just didn't click.
Yeah, that was, you know, going to that point, that would have been December of that year. Yeah. And I believe, like, Undertaker was kind of – he was kept off Survivor Series and then did the big reveal at the end of the show to set up that.
Yep.
And then that was, yeah, the blow-off with Undertaker and Orton.
Where Matt Hardy got in political hot water for not selling The Undertaker enough when he appeared in and killed everyone.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's an interesting story. Man, that guy just couldn't catch a break
shit,
in 2005.
It's so rough because he's a good guy to work with.
And when he did that return, which was that summer, I mean, that was an incredible moment, you know, him showing up very unexpected and giving people that feud they wanted with Edge. And unfortunately, that was the feud that, to me, really cemented Edge at the top end. And unfortunately for Matt, he was kind of just in the same spot he was before he left and then moved over to SmackDown. And it was like that one really benefited Edge. And with Matt Hardy, it was kind of just a kind of fleeting program for him.
And I always, when he comes up, I always like try to put him over for this, man. He was an incredibly good, versatile performer. And we had one of those SmackDowns that Vince, you know, half an hour before the show was changing everything. And we were getting up to showtime. And I was like, how about we put Kennedy versus Hardy out there? And they ended up working three segments. And it was a great match, and they totally had the crowd, and it was totally cool. They were awesome, and a lot of that was Matt just being like, all right, ready to go. Not everybody would have done that. Sylvain would have bitched.
Jeremy in Texas writes, for Alex, was it harder or easier to build to pay-per-views with the brand split, usually only having one every other month? And also, who came up with the mole or whatever you want to call it on Jillian's face? I was ecstatic but grossed out at the same time when the boogeyman bit it off her face a couple of months later.
Nice. That was, I'm almost certain that was Vince McMahon, the mole. What was the other question?
Just promoting the pay-per-views with the brand
schedule a lot more. Because I felt like we had time to tell our stories on television and build into something different. And the brand split gave SmackDown more freedom, I think, than it has now.
Well, the biggest positive of the brand split was the fact that you had these two shows where theoretically you could push a lot more talent rather than having those couple top spots all on one show where, you know, we're seeing it right now. I mean, guys are really overexposed being out there 5 hours a week.
Yeah.
Matches are done over and over and over again. And say what you will about the brand split, but I thought it was a very positive move at the time they did it to try and get more legs out of these programs. Guys aren't out there that much a week on television. You have to watch them either one night or you see the stars on the other night. I mean, it was a sound strategy, I thought, at the time.
I did, too. I liked it more than a lot of people. I mean, I think if you polled the internet wrestling community, they would absolutely go the other way. I mean, that sort of seems to be the sentiment. I liked the – ultimately to me, because I'm a self-centered jerk, the creative freedom that being the B show allowed me, whether or not my work was successful, a lot of it did get on television. And that – I'll take SmackDown every time.
Josh from England here writes, I was wondering if you could share who was your favorite GM for either character and who you enjoyed writing for best at the time.
Favorite GM ever or favorite during my era?
Either. Anyone that stood out for you,
In my ever, and I would have loved to have been a part of it, Regal as GM is absolutely fantastic, I say. Either time, especially the 2 week sort of later run he had before I think he got in trouble for something or another. I just thought he owned the show. It was super fun working with Teddy Long for all of exactly the reasons you would expect. He's hilarious. And it as much of a joke it is on the IWC, it's just as much in the writer's room and with Teddy himself that you got, you know, we're going to do a tag team match between the Undertaker. You know, like he knows what he is. He was a blast to work with.
Paul writes in from the UK for Alex. I've heard a story where you pitched to have someone else do Kevin Dunn's job on SmackDown to give it a different look. We went over that. What are some of the differences you would have liked to have seen in the show's look and production if this had been a successful switch? And what would you suggest they do differently today to freshen up the look? And he also asks if there was any truth to the rumor Muhammad Hassan was at one point scheduled to win the world title on July 4th in Washington.
Certainly not that I
I mean, you would probably know.
Yeah, that feels like I don't think there was ever any plan. It is completely plausible that someone would throw that out in a meeting. I mean, that seems like the kind of obvious idea that you would come up with, but I certainly never heard anything like that.
And
what was the other part? I'm sorry.
Just kind of the aesthetics of SmackDown that you would have liked to have seen.
Oh, like I mean, we were talking about a lot of things. Remember, you know, we got cut off at the knees in the conversation that Court and I pitched it. And then Kevin Dunn spent a week cutting it completely apart. So we never got very far. I mean, we talked about things as different as an almost Fight Clubbier, instead of one giant Tron, a series of Trons, doubled entrances, a heel and a face entrance. In terms of aesthetic value, getting away from the sort of black and blue vibe, which feels injured as opposed to aggressive like Raw's, and looking at some different sort of aesthetic choices. Obviously, I think we would have wanted more what we had, sort of big characters, yes, but an emphasis on the championships and wins and losses are important. Keeping that of the facsimile of athletic competition in it, more overarching week-to-week stories with cliffhangers and that sort of thing. Like, we had a bunch of ideas.
And let's finish off here with Caesar, who wanted to ask about Matt Hardy. And we kind of discussed this, saying that 6 years ago, this was the end of the Matt Hardy Edge feud and would later be moved to SmackDown. Was Hardy moved to SmackDown to be separated from Edge after having a great feud with him, having awesome matches and being over with the crowd? Why was Hardy never given that big singles push?
First moved over to get him away from Edge. Yes, transparently. There's no way you could have had him on the same show at that point and not just had that program continued forever. I actually think there was more steam in that program, but decision makers higher than me, I couldn't tell you who, just decided it was time to be done. And in terms of Matt not reaching his greatest potential, I totally agree. I wish we'd have had a better plan or a better God. His condescending heel character right now, I haven't really seen anything from TNA, but from ROH, is a great character. I wish I'd have had that tool in the toolbox yet. But there was no conspiracy to keep Hardy down once he was on SmackDown, except for some punishment after not selling The Undertaker enough. At that Survivor Series, which was just, I mean, we even said at the time, that's bullshit. Why are you taking this piece off the table when we could use him? And he came back relatively quickly.
All right. So thanks to everyone for all of your questions and feedback to the show. We very much appreciate that.
Thanks for giving us your entire day.
Yes, yes. This is a lot of fun chatting with you, Alex, about this time period. You have a fantastic memory of just so many little stories and stuff, and those are always the fun guests to have that recall this stuff, and it's not just a blur. You can make odds and ends of your time in WWE.
Unless you get me on a courtroom stand, in which case my response is I don't recall.
It was a hazy time.
It was a very hazy time in my past.
So as we wrap up here, the G1, Alex, are you going to be watching any of the tournament?
I am actually later today going to listen to your report and decide whether I should watch the first show.
Was a pretty good first show, I thought. Some very good stuff on
it
there.
Out that Ibushi is out.
Yeah, unfortunately, he has a real terrible concussion.
That sucks, man, because you know that Osaka match with Nakamura was it really was my favorite match I saw last year.
Yeah, there were just some phenomenal matches last year, and I kind of look back, you know, he suffered the concussion really early in the Kushida match, and they just continued in that match where it was like Kushida was like auditioning for Weekend at Bernie's. Like, this was just a corpse he was in the ring with, and why that match just wasn't stopped.
That sucks, man.
For all you know, could have made the concussion that much worse, sure. And it's just, you know, at some point, you know, just call it, because look at this. This guy is in the prime of his career right now. And, you know, when you hear severe concussion and the fact he is missing this tournament, definitely a sign of worry, I would imagine, amongst people. So a bit of a blow to the tournament, but you're still going to get some very, very solid matches. And thankfully, they are on Ustream.
How many stars do you give night one?
You know what? If we're judging it on our scale of Baltimore to the Staples Center, I would say this was slightly above Houston. I would say this was around the 7.5 range, nice. I would say. Nice. It was a very good show. So I don't think there was that one blow away match of
like,
the year.
I suck so bad, like, because I get them individually. I wait for a sort of one of those unanimous, like, remember there was your report and then Meltzer's, and then like everybody talked about that Osaka show, and that's the one I finally ended up getting. And
well, if there's one match, Okada Styles was really strong. Like, I think you would really dig that match a lot. It was I don't want to ruin anything for you, but that was a good match.
Cool. Okay, just hearing that gives me confidence.
So there you go. We will be doing shows after each of the G1 shows, so you can tune in. Next one will be actually up later today at liveaudiowrestling.com, iTunes, Stitcher, all of that great stuff. And we will be back next week on Review Away. And keeping with the Japanese theme, we are going to review the WCW New Japan co-promoted show, Collision in Korea, from 1995. So that will be coming up on next week's review. And in the meantime, Alex, do let our listeners know where they can catch you. Of course, you do pretty regular shows with MSL over at our friends at MLW, and always a fun follow on Twitter.
Yeah, you can hit me at Alex D. Greenfield. And I've got nothing to plug. I'm going to have movies to plug in the fall, and then you won't let me come on the show, and that'll suck. So thanks in advance.
Always an open door invite over here. As Alex, I see what you're slightly doing in the world of podcasting. You are restricting your interviews to Canadians.
It's true, right? That's a very strange thing. I've got to speak to someone from warmer climes.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Alex. And to go on out here, Alex, you are the DJ. Do you have a song you would like to go out to encapsulate No Mercy 2005? Anything off the top of your head?
Oh, I think you have to do Eddie's theme song, right?
Perfect. This will be the official theme song that you did not hear if you watched this on the WWE Network version of No Mercy 2005. So we will chat with you later this week. Thank you for tuning in.
Can you feel the heat? Say hello to Eddie. I don't care if you don't like me. Fight me. If you feel it, hey, beat on me. Yo. I can't be weak. Coming from the streets of the ghetto at the end of the week. I get to keep your dinero. You're fast asleep when I sneak in your Gaza. Your life sucks cause you're bankrupt and I'm laughing. You can't trust me, answer, cause I'm Latin. Yeah. Yo, too many try to tell me what I already know. No. Yeah. Viva la ra. You wanna be Latino? If you're not cheating, you're not trying. Mamacita, I got that passion that's lasting long. Los mujeres fall in love with that Latin charm. One woman isn't enough, amigo. Siempre cogiendo más mujeres porque soy Latino. And I'm tough and tough, calling your blood, cuz I don't care if you don't like me. Everybody wants to fight me. You feel it? Hey, oye lo claro, I ain't the one you wanna meet. Hay nada más caliente, I'm too hot for you.